Well, we're deep into August heat and, of course, summer insects, so we thought it a good time to go to another edition of What's Bugging You here on Red River Radio, our program about the insect world, with Dr. Beverly Burden, an associate professor of biology at LSUS and our resident entomologist. I'm Bill Beckett, the program director here at Red River Radio. And if you'd like to call in during tonight's program, you can give us a call about the insect world, both the fiendish kind and the friendly kind, at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Our program made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm sorry, I went into a retro mode there. Well, Dr. Beverly Burden, welcome back here, and maybe I won't get your name wrong.
It's my pleasure to be back, Bill.
All right. I'm going to have you pull your mic a little closer there, if you could. And, you know, it's funny. We have received so many photographs this month that I really feel that people are kind of bugging out there on bugs. And so that's kind of cool. And of course, phone calls already coming in. We're going to take phone calls as a priority. We'll get to all of the photos on our website as we go through the show, but feel free to call in during the show about anything that we're going to talk about. And Dr. Burden, we've instituted a new thing about a profile species each month. And what do you have for us now?
Well, not necessarily a species, but
or a bug.
And sometimes it could be an individual species, sometimes it could be a group.
Right.
And earlier, a few weeks ago, we got a picture of an earwig.
Mm-hmm.
And an earwig is a rather flat, elongate insect. And it has a very long abdomen, very short, truncated wings, simple antennae. But what makes it very interesting and unique is on the tail end of the earwig is a pair of pinchers. And they use these pinchers to capture prey, and they have two pairs of wings. The front pair of wing is kind of like the wings of grasshoppers. They're leather-like. In fact, the scientific name for this group is Dermaptera, which means skin wing, derm, like dermatology.
Mm-hmm.
And but the hind wings are very thin and delicate, and they're shaped kind of like an ear as a semicircular area. And they use these forceps to fold that hind wing up into behind the protective front wings. And it's been hypothesized that maybe because their hind wings look like an ear, that's why they're called earwigs. But they might also be called earwigs because they do like to crawl into tight spaces. And so back when people wore those white wigs with the very tight curls,
uh-huh,
they would sometimes find them up in there. And a lot of people think that they like to crawl into people's ears, and that may be why they're called earwigs. In fact, for those of you that are within the right age group, as Bill and I are, we can remember a famous show called Night Gallery with, mm-hmm, Rod Sterling. And every time I mention earwigs, people always bring that story up. And the story goes is that an earwig crawled into a man's ear. Now, this is all completely not true, but the story goes that the earwig crawled up into the man's ear, entered into his brain, ate through the brain, and came out the other side. And the doctor says, well, the good news is that the earwig is out of your brain. The bad news is that it was a female and it laid eggs.
Right.
And so, but the truth about earwigs is that they tend to be nocturnal, and so it's not very common to find them during the day. They can range from just maybe a fourth of an inch or smaller, up to almost 3/4 of an inch, depending upon the species. They're omnivores, so they eat almost anything they can find that has organic value to it. The pinchers are kind of unique in the fact that they look like they would just be terrible, but they don't even have enough pressure to barely pinch the skin. And they have a very unique behavior. If they feel threatened, they will arch that tail up. And just like mimicking a scorpion, will take those pinchers and act like they're just going to tear you up with them. But, of course, they're completely harmless. The one thing that they are a pest in, however, is every once in a while, they will get into flower nurseries. And since when the buds start to open up on the flowers, that's a nice tight space for them to crawl into, and then they damage the petals. So when the bud finally opens, it's got all these ripped and torn petals. And so they can be a problem in flower nursery greenhouses. But that's the Airwig story for the day. And I find them to be quite unique little critters. And I enjoy every time I see them.
They are definitely. I'd never seen one before. And there's a photo on the website. It's the second to last photo for this post, for this show. So you can scroll all the down. I actually took this picture. Right outside our station, there's a big sign that says Red River Radio, and there's a concrete flower bed around it. And I just happened to see it crawling there. So it was moving, so I grabbed as many pictures as I could and happened to get a couple that turned out great, because when you're using a phone camera, they don't snap real quick, you know. It's funny because you think the pinchers are the front end of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's what I thought. I saw the pinchers, and I thought, well, they're the front. And then when I looked at the photograph, I saw the antennae, and I thought, oh, no, okay, the pinchers are on the back end of it. And I didn't even notice that it had wings. So,
well, if they're immatures, they won't have fully developed wings.
Okay, maybe I don't know.
It might be an immature, and because I really don't see the front wing pads on it.
Right.
But it may just be an issue of resolution for the photograph.
Mm-hmm.
But, they don't have larval forms. Baby earwigs look like adult earwigs, but without the wings.
Interesting. Now, that story that was on the Night Gallery, that was actually based on a short story by somebody you know, Beverly, Wally Derleth's dad, August Derleth.
Mm-hmm.
That is interesting. Everything kind of comes full circle.
What does that show?
6 degrees of separation or
Absolutely.
Something like that?
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think sometimes it's even less than that. Well, you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we already have two callers online, so we're going to go to our first caller, Leon from Bossier City. Leon, what's bugging you tonight?
Well, I wanted to comment about Rod Sterling.
Okay.
And you certainly are not old enough to remember that. You must have had your big sister tell you about it.
Well, that's very kind of you, Leon, but unfortunately
but
I do remember
Leon.
It.
Both of us do.
as do I.
Yeah.
My question is basically about the wasp in our area, red wasp,
mm-hmm.
that build a paper nest.
Mm-hmm.
When they build the nest and the new guys come out of there, do they go back to that same nest to have to impregnate or make another batch, or do they go and create a new nest somewhere else?
Normally, it's the colony that stays together, and then oftentimes, especially with wasps, they'll have something that's called mating swarms. Well, some will go out and form a new colony. Now, when you see a nest, they're basically all sisters. The queen of the nest, the main one, is the one that's laying the eggs. The other ones are basically foraging. And yes, they form a little paper cup of a nest. In fact, I got stung by one Saturday afternoon about 3 o'clock. It hurts like the devil. And no more than, just a little while, then you get better. But, oftentimes you'll hear people call them mahogany wasp or red wasp. They are closely related to the yellow jackets. They're all in the same family that's called Vespides. And my best advice is just to leave them alone or go out and get you a cannet that shoots 27 feet and take care of them. And, the problem with that, Leon, is a lot of people will go out there during the day and spray the nest down. And most of the colony is out foraging for food. And so you should really go out there early evening or early morning when they're all still at home, and you get a little bit more kill power to your efforts. And I know a lot of people might be offended about that, but we are not decimating the wasps. It's just that they think that they're in their backyard, and we think that they're in our backyard, and that's where the problem starts.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, thank you for the information. Your show is absolutely informative and fun to hear.
Thank you, Leon. I appreciate that. Keep listening.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Leon. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. And we have almost all lines open right now, so you'll get in pretty quickly. 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we're going to go next to Laura from El Dorado. Laura, what's bugging you tonight?
Hello.
Hello.
Dr. Burden.
Yes.
Thank you for teaching us.
No problem. What's bugging you today, Laura?
Until recently, I lived in 500 acres of timber, and they've clear cut not far from my home.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is that the red ants, the hot ants,
mm-hmm. fire ants,
the singing ants, will be moving into that area. I wonder. I am very proud that my home is organic, and we have lots of wonderful things here. And I don't know, I've been told to create a barrier between the clear-cut area and my home, but I don't really want to put out poison. But Dr. Beverly, those red ant mounds are awful, and I don't need a or want a yard full of them. Have you encountered this, and how should I react?
Well, first of all, a barrier is not going to stop them, because what fire ants do, and it's like clockwork. You can set your watch to it. After we have a rain event, if it gets above a certain temperature the next day, or even later in the afternoon, they will go on what's called mating swarms. And there'll be all these winged fire ants that will leave the mound, go on these mating swarms, and then the female, after she's mated, will then start a new colony. Now, there's been a lot of talk about different types of organic ways to dispose of the fire ant mounds. What I tend to do, I do use an insecticide. It's called acephate, and it only takes a little bit. But it smells terrible. But if you don't want to go in that direction, what I've noticed is I walk with a walking stick, and when I pass by a fire ant mound, I'll just disturb it, and I find out if I do that enough and often enough, they'll give up and leave. So just pester them. And
like they do us.
Yeah.
Very good.
Fair is fair, right? And so you might try that. A lot of people try hot water. I've never seen any scientific documentation that works, but some people do claim that it does work. And so, but that's also another form of disturbance. And so that's what I would try. The weird thing about fire ants, the other interesting thing about fire ants, though, Laura, is people say, well, if you kill one mound or you get rid of one mound, then they'll just move. Well, that's not true. If you see a fire ant mound out in your yard, what you don't see is that there's other little bitty small colonies throughout that area. And that big mound is suppressing the smaller colonies. And so when you do away with the main mound, then that allows some of the other mounds to pop up because they're no longer being dominated and suppressed. And so it looks like they move, but they're just making way for, you know, a smaller mound to then thrive.
A final question. Thank you kindly. Mm-hmm. I will disturb the mound. I can do it. I have two or three walking sticks.
Good.
Dr. Burden, would diatomaceous earth do any good at all?
No. Diatomaceous earth is normally for soft-bodied animals, because mm-hmm. it scratches their exoskeleton and causes them to not be able to maintain their moisture level. They basically dry out if that waxy mm-hmm. layer is scratched off. And so dichotomous earth, you just be wasting your time, effort, and money.
All right. That's everything I need to know. I'll follow your instructions, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura.
All right. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. And you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And by the way, if you'd like to instruct your kids at all, we have a whole bunch of photos on our website. Just go to redriverradio.org and click on the What's Bugging You post. These are all insects that have been submitted to us to identify, and we'll get to as many of these tonight as possible, and then we'll get the names up later on after the show. I've already got all the names, so we're just waiting to read those out on the air. But we have more callers coming in right now, and Nicholas from Angelina River, what's bugging you tonight?
Hey, how y'all doing?
We're doing fine, Nicholas. What can we do for you tonight? What's bugging you?
I witnessed an unusual occurrence with some wasps, but I was hoping you could give me some insight into that. So it's going to be a wasp episode, I guess.
Okay.
And also, I have an old-timer's kind of wives' tale he told me, and I just want to see if that's true also.
Okay.
Four questions. First one is, I had an old-timer tell me that if you leave a wasp nest up, wasps are territorial, and after the wasps leave, other wasps won't build a nest close to them. So by leaving them up, you keep them away from your house. Is that true?
Well, I have not witnessed that, but what I have witnessed is on the back of my father's house, there'll be empty nests left over from the previous season, but new nests will still be built. And so from the evidence that I've witnessed, that is not true.
That sounds good. It might be an urban legend.
Mm-hmm.
Or a rural legend, I should say.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, my next question is, I was under my garage, and my garage is like 12 feet high, and I leave those wasp nests because of what the man told me, right? So I was fixing something on my truck, and I noticed, I knew there was a big wasp nest above me, but they didn't bug me, so I left them alone. And I was fixing my truck, and the wasp nest suddenly fell to the floor of the asphalt underneath me. And then the wasps, they swarmed all around like crazy. And I thought at first something had hit the nest, but then I realized that I looked at the nest real closely, and there were no pupa in it. All the holes were empty, and I think they cut down the nest themselves, because about 7 days later, they were still there and didn't rebuild the nest or anything. Do they cut down nests for some reason?
I've never heard of it, and
it was unusual.
Yeah. I don't have an explanation for that, other than you just might be an unlucky guy having wasp nests fall on you like that. That's not a good thing at all.
I
keep looking up, you know, to make sure I wasn't underneath a wasp nest, because it might fall on me. But the fact that it didn't have any brood in it is interesting, though, to me.
I know. I was wondering, maybe the queen died or something.
It could be.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. I thought it was unusual. I thought maybe there was a common answer to that.
Nope. I've never run across it before. And but you know what? The minute you think you know everything that's going on in Mother Nature, mm-hmm. you'll find something new.
Amen.
That's right.
Well, thank you very much. That's helpful either way.
Thank you, Nicholas.
Yeah, well, maybe that maybe the wasp was a bachelor. You never know, or maybe he had gotten kicked out. You know, for not taking out the trash. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. She is taking your phone calls tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we go next to David from Lufkin. David, you're on with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you?
Thank you very much. I was listening to the lady that had a problem with fire ants.
Yeah.
And, this is something new I'm trying out that I got on YouTube, and it sure did work for me. There were some fire ants. I feed my dogs. I boil some chicken sometimes and throw out the hot water next to the house. They love the earth to be hot. And so they build a, you know, the next day there's a nest right there on the earth. And so, you know, this would happen once in a while, and then they would crawl around the house, and, you know, everything had ants on it. So I've been using, you know, pesticides and stuff, and I got sort of, you know, that I didn't want to use those either, like that lady. So I looked up that there was this guy on YouTube that was using half sugar and half borax, you know, boric acid.
Mm-hmm,
and then with a little bit of water, and then they put it in a container, and then at the bottom of the container, they made little holes, you know. And that's so, you know, if a dog wants to eat it, it will, you know, it will have a problem, to, you know, doing that. But so I just put a small container out there with this wet mixture in it. The very next day, the whole mound was totally gone. And I, you know, dug it up a little bit. No ants at all. Amazing. I've been trying to get rid of ants. You know, the other stuff works, but this stuff, I don't know, it really knocked the mound out. So I was really surprised because I guess it's sort of an organic method, but as far as it, I'm new with it, you know, but it seems to be working for me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, first of all, why are you throwing away good chicken broth? That's what I want to know.
I know, yeah.
Yeah, don't do that.
Well, but, I've tried not to do that and put it in my dog food, but my dogs get so fat.
Yeah.
That, so I just throw out the fat, you know, and, you know, it's a treat once in a while for them, you know, but I don't want to have chicken broth around the house, you know.
There's some scientific evidence to back up what you're saying about the chicken broth, because if you take something sweet, sugary, something high in protein, and then something high in fat, and you see how many ants will come to it, they favor the fat before they'll favor the protein, before they'll favor the sugar. The sugar, however, probably isn't attracted. The active ingredient, what you're talking about, is borax. Borax has been used as an insecticide, and in a way you can call it organic, because it's just an element. If you look on a periodical chart, that you have borax right there, and it's been used successfully to kill cockroaches. That's what a lot of cockroach powder is for, is boric acid, and it actually acts like a stomach poison. And when it gets down into the intestine, it actually blows little holes in the intestine. And they will just think about it. If your intestines had little holes in it, you wouldn't be very happy either. And they'll eventually die because of that. And so if it's working for you, David, I say good deal. Go ahead and start working with it.
Yeah, this container was just chock full of ants. They had gone in there, and some of them that were beginning to take back this mixture to the queen actually died doing it. So there was just tons of dead ants in there. And I guess a few of them took it back to the queen. But I think the trick is to not make it liquid. Just put enough liquid in there to
make it a paste.
You know, make it like a frothy mixture.
Right.
And so that they can take it back.
Right.
And it really surprised me. It really did work. And so I looked it up on YouTube again, and there are a lot of enthusiastic people that are doing this. So, I'm gonna start making a lot of those little containers and putting them around and see if this thing does hold up, you know.
Yeah, well, every good experiment has to be replicated.
Right.
Yeah.
I know how that lady feels, you know.
Sure.
I actually like the smell of that insecticide.
Acephate?
Yeah, I like that. It's too bad it's toxic, you know, but...
Don't be snorting that stuff.
Oh, no, 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 no.
All right. Well, thank you for your call.
Okay, I'm just glad my dogs don't like it, too.
Absolutely.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton. And we have a full bank of phones right now lined up, and we're going to go next to Jimbo. Jimbo, what's bugging you?
Hey, can you hear me all right?
Yep.
Okay, I've got two insects I'm dealing with in two different environments. I've got cucumber beetles out in the field, and I've got aphids in the greenhouse. Now, with the crop that I'm dealing with, We have certain EPA regulations that we have to follow, so I'm wondering if there are any natural remedies to extinguish either of these insects. I've used neem oil on the aphids in the greenhouse with minimal success. Nothing for the cucumber beetles yet out in the field.
Yeah, cucumber beetles are going to be tough. Once they get established, it's pretty much a done deal. Once they get into those vines with the cucumbers. Have you tried spraying the aphids with a mild soap mixture?
I have used soap on the aphids, which works very well.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it also killed the plant as well. So.
Well, then it's too concentrated. Dilute it down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm talking about a teaspoon in a gallon of water. That would okay. still be enough to knock out the aphids. And what that soap is doing, Jimbo, is that it's removing that protective wax layer off of the aphids, and then they're drying out. They have a hard time maintaining body moisture when you do that. And so I would still play around and get the right concentration of the soap, because without it being toxic to the plant, what plant are they on?
This is industrial hemp.
Okay. Don't know a lot about that, because that's new. But, I would keep trying to mess around with the soap, because that's going to be okay. your best bet. For the cucumber aphids, the only thing I could tell you to do is, if you're not using any you're not using any insecticide at all on your cucumber plants, is that correct?
That's correct. No, we haven't used any insecticide.
If I were to, I would try a 7-Dust, a carbaryl, or even a liquid carbaryl spray that might be effective, or maybe a pyrethrin might be effective. But it depends on how widespread the damage is. It looks like you're doing industrial cropping, and if you got a large acreage that's infested with the cucumber beetle, that's not good. And so best of luck with that if you don't want to, you know, go in and use some hardcore insecticides.
All right. I certainly appreciate it.
Thank you for your call. Yeah.
All right.
Cucumber beetles are tough.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton. And I'll get it straight here tonight, folks. And we've got Ben next from Dry Prong. I hope this is you, Ben. Ben, you're on with Dr. Burton. What's bugging you?
Phones.
Okay, well, there you go. I think you were laughing earlier when I was trying to go to you, and somehow the lines got screwed up.
I'm sorry about that. It might have been the dogs.
Oh, it could be. Yeah, you never know.
Root knot nematodes.
Root knot nematodes.
Did terrible things in my okra this year. I started a new bed. My older beds, I'm not having trouble in those. Okay?
Uh-huh.
I've got lots of stuff cut into those, you know, compost and my worm castings and stuff like that. They're just full of it. This new bed, I just scratched up some soil, put a little manure into it, and started to spring with it. And like I said, they did terrible things to my okra, and I don't want them to jump on my beets.
Now, yeah.
When the weather cools down, you know, they're going to cool down also.
Yeah.
But I like to go ahead and get my stuff in the ground.
Right. With root knot nematodes, oftentimes there are predaceous nematodes, fight nematodes with nematodes.
Mm-hmm.
I would look into that. They do a lot of that in crops that absolutely cannot have any kind of organic or inorganic pesticide on them. Things like mint, and there are predaceous nematodes that you can treat and spray with that. And I would give that a try. Just search on the internet, predaceous nematodes, and see what comes up. And I can guarantee you there'll be a company where you can purchase some from.
Yeah, I had seen them online. I want to ask you about something else, though.
Okay.
I also have some 38% pyrethrin that I can mix up into a bottle, you know, a spray bottle.
Mm-hmm.
Cut the bed up, spray it on, cut the bed up, spray it on. And will that work on them until it cools down? I also have some Timbor, which is a borate salt.
Yeah.
That I use on my, I got a little sawmill. After I saw some lumber that I'm going to use outside, I'll treat with the Timbor. I was wondering if I could cut some of that into the ground.
You know, I don't know if an insecticide, most of the pyrethrins are nerve poisons.
I see.
And, of course, nematodes have nerves, but not as extensive as insects do. And so the mode of action may not work on nematodes. And I don't know to say, yeah, go ahead, it'll work. Go ahead and try it. It may work. And the next show, call me back and let me know. Or give me an email. Email beverly.burden@lsus.edu.
Since you mentioned it like that, the Tim Boar might actually sound a little more promising.
Okay.
Which I'm saying it's a borate salt. It's
Similar
to borax, but, you know, it's specialized for termites and stuff that gets in the wood. Okay. I'll experiment and let you know.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
All right, Ben. Thank you. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, tonight. There, I got it right. And you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're going to go next to Elizabeth from Jefferson, Texas. Elizabeth, what's bugging you?
Yes, Dr. Burden.
Uh-huh.
My next-door neighbor, honestly, if it was me, I would say it, but my little next-door neighbor has pantry moths,
yeah.
And she can't get rid of them. Is there anything, I don't know anything, to tell her? What do you think?
I have two suggestions.
Okay.
One, they're called Indian meal moths, and they like to feed on any kind of dry beans, nuts, even flour, meal, things like that. And when they get ready to pupate, the immatures are like little caterpillars. And when they get ready to go into the quiet stage and pupate before they emerge as an adult, they will crawl away from their feeding area. I've had them twice, and this is the only thing that has ever worked for me. Take everything out of the pantry and find out what is the hot spot. There's going to be one thing in that pantry, maybe two, but at least one thing in that pantry where they're feeding on it. And, of course, that needs to be put in the trash, tied up, and gone. And then take a mild solution of bleach. If you can remove the shelving, remove the shelves, wipe down behind the shelves with a mild bleach solution, wipe down the top of the shelves, destroy any insect that they run across, and then before they put everything back into the pantry, she needs to put it into thick plastic containers, like Ziploc, because they can chew through Ziploc plastic, but I'm talking about like Tupperware, Rubbermaid, things like that. And then the next time she goes to the store and say buy some flour, put it in the freezer for 3 days and then put it in the pantry, because if there's any infestation that she might be bringing in, that will kill it. Now, the second thing she can do is she can go in and buy what we call some pheromone traps. And these pheromone traps will attract the moths in and they'll get on this sticky glue patch. And that is one way not to kill them off, but to monitor them, and so to make sure if they do start to become established again, she can nip it in the bud very early. But it's going to take a lot of just cleaning and making sure that she stores the stuff properly. And then if she wants to put a pheromone trap in her pantry to monitor, then that would be part two.
Okay, where would she get a pheromone trap?
Well, there's several companies that are out there, and just have her do Indian meal moth pheromone trap. Google it, and they'll pop up.
Okay. Well, you know, I told her, I said, I've heard of these, but my mother always said, once you get them, you just can't get rid of them. And so I've always, whenever I get anything like flour or cornmeal or anything, I put it in my refrigerator. That's where I keep it till I use it.
Mm-hmm. But, that's a good practice.
I'm going to. I'll tell her about this. She's quite frugal. I know she's not going to want to throw a lot of things out, but I'm going to tell her what the solutions are.
Well, she just have to be very, very persistent
diligent.
Yes. Absolutely, Elizabeth. Okay. Well, I hope your neighbor has success.
Thank you so much, Dr. Burton.
You're very welcome, Elizabeth. Thank you for calling.
I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, we are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. We have all open lines right now, so folks, you can get right in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502, and give us a call right now. We have all lines open, as I said. In the meantime, we have a bunch of photographs that were submitted, and we're going to go to the first one here. And this was submitted by, I believe, Christina, and she writes, Dr. Burton, my aunt sent me this picture of a bee she killed, wanting to know what kind it is. She lives in Crosby, Texas, which is outside of Houston, and we really would appreciate your expert help in identifying the bee.
Well, Christina, it's not a bee. It is a fly. Flies are the only, well, not the only group, but the major group of insects that only have one pair of wings. And when I first saw this, I looked at it once and I looked at it twice because it's a black and white insect on a white, a salt pepper kind of a background. Mm-hmm. But what we're looking at here is what we call a robber fly. And robber flies are called robber flies because they're very aggressive ambush predators. Just like if somebody was going to, you know, carjack you, aggressive ambush predators. And they have mouth parts that act like a little dagger, and they eat other insects. And what they do is they will take this mouth part that's like a dagger, a little knife, and they stab the prey and inject it with saliva that contains two chemicals. One chemical, it will paralyze the insect, and the other chemical will start to digest and break down the internal contents, the insides of the insect, and then they'll reinsert their mouth part and just suck all the liquid out. And they come in, this is the one of the most common body forms. They can also be round like a bee, but this one is not. This is a classic robber fly. They have big, big eyes, and one of the classic things, you can't really see it on this picture, but at the very top of their head, it's kind of sunken in. It's called a sunken vortex. And sometimes they will actually bite humans, and it's a very painful bite, kind of like a horse fly. And so don't be messing with the robber flies. So it's not a bee at all, but it is a robber fly.
All right, and we're going to go to this next one to get this in. And this is from Dennis Gibson, who lives over in Fort Polk. And Dennis lives over there, and he said he saw this bug at work close to Fort Polk in Vernon Parish. And they crawl up his pants leg and down his shirt collar and all over the office building. They don't bite or sting and does fly around. Favors lightning bugs, but is not. And he wanted to know exactly what that was.
When I first saw this picture, Bill, if you could scroll down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Up.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
The first thing I thought was that it looks like a blister beetle. But it didn't have a couple of the key characteristics that the blister beetle has. And so I thought, okay, if it's not a blister beetle, I look at the antenna, and the antenna are long, and the rule of thumb between longhorn wood boring beetles versus plant beetles is that the antenna has to be at least half as long or longer than the body if it's going to be a longhorn wood boring beetle. And that's kind of hard to judge, and so I was thinking, well, maybe it's a plant beetle. And I just happened to get a call from a colleague, Dr. Lord, that's in the entomology department at in Baton Rouge. And I said, what do you think this is? And he sent it back. He goes, that is a false blister beetle.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was on the right track, but I don't run across this family of beetles very often. And so I got a little help from a friend. And the reason that they're called blister beetles, but either the true blister beetles or the false blister beetles is that they contain a chemical in them called cantharidin. And if this cantharidin gets on the skin, it can cause irritation and sometimes an actual blister. And they do have that habit of crawling down shirts. And so the behavior was dead on. And that's why I was still leaning toward blister beetles other than the longhorn wood boring beetles. And so these also contain cantharidin, and they are complete pollen feeders, which is kind of unique because there's not a lot of nutritional value sometimes in pollen. And so, that's what it is. It was unusual for me, but like I said, I reached out and phoned a friend and got a little help on it. And love the picture. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's a great picture. So, and thank you, Dennis. And we'll get to your next picture as soon as we can. But we've got phone calls online. By the way, you're listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Bird. And you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. We're going to go to Rob from Lufkin next. Rob, you're on with Dr. Bird. What's bugging you tonight?
I just had a general purpose question. We recently set up a garden in our backyard, and I wanted to know her opinion on what she thought a good natural insecticide would be for a garden where you're growing fruit and vegetables.
Oftentimes, it's your oils, your organic oils, things like citronella oil. There's other types of oils that you can use. The neem oil, a lot of people have good success with neem oil. Some people have good success with oil of lemon or oil of eucalyptus. And what I also tell people is try to maintain a nice, healthy, diverse ecosystem, so that will attract natural predators as well. And so that would be my advice for you, Rob.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
All right. Thank you, Rob. And we are going to go next to Vicki from Simpson, Louisiana. Vicki, you're on with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you tonight?
Hi, Dr. Burden.
Hi.
I had a terrible problem with Indian meal moths a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And I tried everything. I was desperate. I was chasing little caterpillars with a broom up on my roof. It was horrible. It was like a nightmare. And I had a pesticide company come out, and they told me about the little pheromone traps and that stuff, but I'll tell you what worked. I used a bomb, you know, one of those in an aerosol can.
Right.
I bought it at Walmart or Lowe's, and it was just an over-the-counter kind of bomb, and I opened up all my cabinets, and the can said that it was safe to use in kitchens, and I got rid of the meal moths. Now, I don't know if it's a coincidence that I renovated my kitchen at the same time, and it may have helped that I just tore the whole kitchen out, but I did get rid of the meal moths. And I was elated because they can be a nightmare. So I just wanted to let that lady know that called earlier that maybe mm-hmm. she could try a bomb.
Yeah, bombs. I'm glad it worked for you, but for Elizabeth's neighbor, it may not be quite as effective. A lot of it depends on the overall three-dimensional component, whether you have shallow cabinets, whether you have deep cabinets, whether they're lightly stocked, whether they're heavily stocked, how well the bomb can actually penetrate into the area. I would say that would be the last resort, because most people don't want any chemicals associated with their food. But like I said, it was a last resort for you, and it worked, and I'm glad it did. But most of the time, bombs have proven not to be all that effective. But I'm glad it worked for you, and thank you for sharing.
Thank you. Have a good night.
You too.
Too. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. There, I got it right. And we're going to next to Connie from Shreveport. Connie, you're on with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you?
Fruit flies.
Yeah.
So, hi, I really enjoy listening to your show when I cook dinner and to the ornithology show when I cook dinner.
And don't get me mixed up now.
I know. Sorry. Didn't mean to mess you up. So, 2 weeks ago, I went to the farmer's market and bought some peaches, which I had been buying down in Coushatta prior to the closing of some of the farms down there, and brought the peaches home, and within 30 minutes, I just had a swarm of fruit flies in the house. And I have put little dishes of vinegar out, and that's caught some of them, but I just can't seem to get them gone. Do you have any advice for me, please?
Well, yes, I do. You know, if you have fruit laying out, especially fruit that's very volatile, it puts out a lot of good, you know, smells in the air, then the fruit flies are going to be attracted to that. But dishes of vinegar may work, but it's the way that you're putting it out. What uh-huh. I do is I take a little glass jar, uh-huh. say of something like my husband, Wally, likes to put sliced mushrooms on almost everything. And so I buy sliced mushrooms in these little glass jars, uh-huh. and I'll rinse them out, and I'll put some cheap wine in there, something that's fermented but yet and fruity.
That's great. I'm cooking with some tonight.
But here's the trick. Here's the trick, Connie. You have to take, when you put the lid on, punch a couple holes in there,
right.
Because they'll be able to get in, but they won't be able to get out.
Mm. Okay. So I've got these vinegar dishes covered with saran wrap and rubber banded with little holes. And, I mean, I feel masochistic because I'm watching them get in and think,
Yeah.
But you think wine works better than vinegar, huh?
Almost 90% of the time for 90% of the problems in the world.
Absolutely. Well, I will use some of my leftover wine that I'm cooking with tonight and give that a shot to see if I can get rid of the last.
Yeah, try to get away from the dishes and the saran wrap. I just don't feel comfortable with that.
Okay.
But, right. Yeah. I like to really, I like the little glass jars better. But if that works for you, using the wine, well, then keep using it.
Okay.
You might kind of want to do it in a little experiment and have both out and see which one is the most efficient.
Yeah, I feel like I'm down to like the last three or four, but they seem like they're really big ones and they just won't go away.
The other thing about flies in general, and this goes for gnats as well, any kind of wet organic matter, like you have a lot of house plants, they'll lay eggs in that.
Right.
And so you want to not have a lot of wet organic matter available for them.
Right. And it's okay for like a house plant to be several rooms away, or is that not even going to do the trick?
Probably it would be okay. You know,
okay.
distance is probably better than nothing.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I will give the wine a try.
Thank you.
Thanks. Have a great evening.
So now the fruit flies, is that the Drosophila?
Drosophila.
Drosophila?
And there's actually two different families of fruit flies, but the most one that people are commonly know about is Drosophila.
Okay. That was the one that I had to study in biology. Just curious. Yes, I had to actually dissect the salivary gland of those and do a slide of DNA.
Yep, a DNA squash.
Yes, exactly. That was my only biology class in college, but it was fun. So, well, we've got open lines right now, folks. 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we have about 9 minutes left in the show. In the meantime, we're going to go on to some of the other photos on our website.
I want to talk about that photo you have up there now.
Okay, that's Dennis Gibson. That was the second photo that he sent in.
That is a perfect profile picture of a robber fly right there.
Really? Okay.
You can see that elongated, tapering abdomen.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at where the mouth parts are supposed to be, it's called a proboscis.
Okay.
And that's what does the damage. They'll stick that in other insects and inject their saliva in it, It'll paralyze them. It'll start internal digestion, and then they'll suck out all the digestive juices. And they have that classic V-shaped antenna, too. Mm-hmm. You couldn't see it on the other picture, and you can't see the sunken head, but I can guarantee you that right below that antenna is a dip on the top of their head, a little sucking area. We call it a sucking vortex. A vertex.
You can even see the hairs on his legs there.
Yeah, well, hairs on flies can be a very important characteristics when you're keying out, when you're identifying some flies. Mm-hmm. You literally have to count the hairs on some of their thoracic plates. Hmm. And so it's kind of a
tedious job.
I love it.
There you go.
Put me in a lab is where I have to count the hairs on a fly.
There you go.
And I'm a happy girl.
So, and before you were saying wine, and so you catch more flies with honey than vinegar, right? As the old saying goes.
I guess maybe you could talk about mead, which is honey wine.
There you go. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and we're going to get to one more photo before we go back to the phones here. And this one was sent in by Nick Brumley, who's a musician here in the area and has played in our studio many times. And we already know what this is, but I just, for folks who have never seen an up-close dead one of these, you can look on our website and see an up-close dead one of these, complete with the hourglass on its belly.
Yeah, that's a black widow. It's a female because I can tell by the size. Good job putting down that quarter so I can have a size reference for it. I appreciate that. Now, with that hourglass on there, sometimes it's incomplete and sometimes it may be not quite as red as that. That's a classic one.
Mm-hmm.
Lactodectus mactans is the scientific name, but the black widow and the brown recluse are the two most toxic spiders that we have in this area. Neither one of them are deadly, but they have two different types of toxins that they use. With the black widow, it's what we call a neurotoxin. So it's a toxin that acts on the nerves. And the bite of the black widow, I've never been bitten, but authorities tell me that the bite of a black widow can be extremely painful. Now, black widows normally aren't that aggressive unless they're disturbed.
Right.
And so leave them alone. And but the toxin of the brown recluse is what we call a cytotoxin, C-Y-T-O toxin. And that means that it's a toxin that breaks down cells.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what causes the lesions. But the thing about it is if you let a spider bite get to the point where you have a gaping hole in your skin,
mm-hmm.
you've waited too long to go get medical assistance because you can nip it in the bud before it ever gets bad. You know, people hear horror stories. I lost a finger and stuff like that.
Right.
But that's absolutely not necessary if you seek medical treatment.
There you go. And we did have no photo sent in, but a question. But you've already answered that for James Liu. And that was about fruit flies, about how to get rid of them. And they were having a little bit of a problem. He Googled fruit fly parasite and didn't come up with anything. But he wanted to know if you had any thoughts. So James used those little jars with the lid on them, put some wine in them, and punched some holes in them. Small holes, I presume.
Yeah. What I use is an old-fashioned ice pick.
Mm-hmm.
And so the hole is about the size of about twice the size of a grain of rice.
Right.
If you can drop a grain of rice in there, it's a good size.
Okay. And we've got John from Fishbill on a line right now. John, what's bugging you tonight?
Well, I'm following up on the fruit fly thing, and we do have to say red wine is what attracts them most into your trap, and that trap does work. But I've gone one step further, and it is, I don't have a fruit fly in my kitchen at this time. And what I started doing is any scraps I have, I don't just throw them in the trash can or leave them laying out. I isolate the smell by putting them either in a Ziploc bag or in a covered jar so that the fruit flies don't have anything to come to eat. They don't smell it if you secure it that way. And it's worked for me. I don't have a fruit fly in my kitchen. I just started doing this about 2 months ago, and it's the way I'm controlling them.
Well, that makes great sense, John, because insects have fantastic ability to smell. And they can smell things in the air that their smell is more sensitive than our smell. And so if they're not, if they don't have anything to be attracted to, then if they can't smell it, then they won't come about. So, hey, I like that idea.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing.
It worked for me, so yeah. I wanted to pass it on.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
All right.
You guys keep up the good work.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. And we're going to go to our next photo, which is a couple of little hairy dudes here. And this is from Jessica Poor in Farmersville. She's sent in a few images over the time. And she says she had posted these images of this little fuzzy wuzzy online and said, "I swear he screamed at me, 'I am the night, me roll up and ignore you.'" And just wondering what this little critter is.
Well, this little caterpillar is related to another little caterpillar called the woolly bear caterpillar. Woolly bear caterpillars turn into woolly bear moths, and they there's a folklore. It's never really been scientifically proven. This one guy worked for 17 years, but his data never really came together. But the Farmer's Almanac story goes that a lot, these are primarily black, but a true woolly bear has a black head, a black tail, and then some red fuzzy things and spines in the middle. And the folk tale goes that the whiter the red is, the milder the winter.
Hmm.
And so these will actually turn into a tiger moth. And I appreciate Jessica for sending them in. They're a nice little, I'd like to know what size they are, though, because it's hard for me to tell.
Right.
But it's pretty cute. Yeah, one just curled up and said, "Forget you," right?
Yep, pretty much. Lots of insects out there. And we're going to get to this last photo very quickly. Dave Dial sent this in, and he wanted to know, he's from Groverton, Texas, he wanted to know what kind of wasp this is. He was able to dispatch a spider so large it could barely drag it.
Yeah, this is what some people call them dirt daubers. Some people call them mud daubers. What they do is they'll take and collect spiders, and some of them are very picky about which species of spiders that they'll collect, and then they will build a mud cavity, a mud container, and put this spider in there and lay eggs on it, and the young will basically eat the spider alive. One of the most common dirt daubers around here, you'll see their little mud things on the walls. They look like, it's called the organ pipe dirt dauber. And some of them are what we call kleptoparasites. They will come in behind another dirt dauber and lay their eggs on their spider. And so it's almost like a parasite of a parasite. And so that's what that is.
All right. And very quickly, this came in from Camden, New Jersey. And I know it's a lantern fly, but if you could give us a brief explanation of this.
Yeah, this belongs to a group of insects that are called plant hoppers. And this spotted lantern fly is actually an invasive species from Asia. And it does a lot of damage to trees and other fruit crops, grapes, peaches, plums. They really like what something that's called the Tree of Heaven, and it was first recognized and identified in Pennsylvania in 2014. And so in 6 years, it's pretty much spread and spread and spread. And so where did you say they took this picture?
In Camden, New Jersey.
Yeah. And so not too far off from Pennsylvania then.
And everybody online was posting kill it right away because it's invasive species.
Yep.
And it was identified by her friends. So
yeah.
All right. Well, Dr. Burden, I want to thank you so much for joining us again.
It's my pleasure, Bill. When are we on next?
We are on next, I believe, on September 15th.
Okay.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden at the LSUS and Red River Radio's entomologist. The program made possible tonight by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Wally Derleth answered our phones tonight, and we've got to go. Radio Lab is next.